Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is a HeadGum Podcast.
The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. The Marvelous
Sybil
and Pears. Tony Shalhoub and Rose. I use her character name, not her actress name. Marion Hinkle, Marion Hinkle, J.K., Amazon Prime, Jeff Bezos.
Weird
thank
stuff, but
you,
okay.
Roy
you're shitting in Paris. You're shitting
too.
In Paris.
You're
two
shitting
episodes.
In Paris.
Shooting in Paris.
I thought you said you're shitting in Paris.
I thought
Paris.
I said shitting.
Welcome to the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel Goys. I'm Kevin.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the
Maisel
Goys. Hello, hello, hello.
Hello, hello, hello.
Still banking
these.
Still banking these episodes before they come out. So if you hated 201,
yeah.
We'll never know.
Michael Cohen just got 3 years in prison. And
yeah, let's go super topical.
Well, I'm just saying it's so interesting because, you know, we're in this weird historical time where things are moving really quickly towards maybe, I don't know, a horrible end. And so by the time these come out, it'll be funny what is going on politically now, today, when you're listening.
There is a specific sort of arrogance and audacity that I can
to
define. I would define in podcasting 2016 podcast pre-November. Where everyone was just like, and then Trump's gonna win, la 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 la. Like, everyone loved making those jokes, except for a few people. Usually people of color were like, I don't know, guys. I think he might. Like, I remember Nicole Byer saying on a show, like, I don't know, nothing seems to touch this guy. I think he's gonna win.
She did.
Everyone laughing at her, and now, like, that's a specific kind of arrogance. Mm-hmm. I wonder if we would ever repeat again. I remember doing that on Gilmore. Like, we recorded 722 days before the election. And I made jokes on that thing that I had to cut out because it was such a bummer to put out in the episode. But you know, it's not a bummer. Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Wow, look how you brought it back.
Hey!
How do you do it, guys?
This is a show that seems primarily concerned with delighting people and pleasing an audience rather than like, what's important about this? What matters?
Giving the audience pleasure.
Right? I don't think Amy thinks what she does is important. Do you know what I mean? I don't think she thinks it's important. I think she thinks it's great. But do you know, you understand the difference in what I'm saying?
Like, I know.
I think the people who make The Handmaid's Tale are like, this is the story and narrative that actually is going to help a lot of people. I think Amy's like, I want to entertain people. I don't really give a shit. I think it's great. I'm great, but
no,
I don't...
but I think that, like, you know how the conversation we were having about A Star Is Born?
Mm-hmm. Oh,
how,
yeah.
Like, Gaga's character was like, AKA A Star Is Born. Gaga's character starts doing pop music, and she's having that fight with Jackson Maine, and Jackson Maine's like, you don't like what you're doing now, Jersey.
Hey, again, or lady.
You're just an ugly bitch.
She's like, what?
He improvised that. The bathtub thing where he called her ugly like 20 times.
Isn't that
wild?
So he's been through 301.
Yeah.
At UCB. So anyway.
Bradley at 301.
You're ugly.
I'm like, wow, what a breakthrough. So,
Mr. President.
Oh, yeah. So she decided to do this pop music and she was like, I would have supported if she would have gone, I make this music because I think it's important for somebody that looks like me to make this kind of music that people dance to.
The Ass in the Jeans music, yeah.
The Ass in the Jeans music, because I noticed that everybody who makes this music is like these like little tiny teeny bopper 16-year-olds. And like, if you enjoy this music and you're, you know, it's nice to have it reflected. And you know, there's a lot of ways to say that what I'm doing is important, even if it's fluffy. I feel like that could be a way that Amy looks at what she's doing. Like, I'm filling a niche in the entertainment world that, like, that there needs to be. And these – like, I think what she's doing is important for sure.
Yeah. You know,
so, like, I don't see why her thinking what she's doing is important would be that far off. But yes, it's true that the people who make The Handmaid's Tale think what they're doing is really important, and they're wrong.
I mean, but it is a difference. I want to get our guest in this conversation, so I'm going to introduce her now.
We have a guest, you guys.
Ladies and gentlemen, she is a writer. She is a comedian. You may know her from her wonderful podcast, Everything Is Coming Up Since. And
seems onus.
Give it up for Julia Prescott. I added an is. Everything is coming up.
Everything
the Simpsons.
Is coming up the Simpsons. Yeah.
So
that's hilarious.
Julia, thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks
show.
So much for BT having Dubs. Me.
To kind of like put a bow on this conversation, though, maybe there's a way to look at it like the way that rock critics talk about poptimism. You guys know that, like, rockism versus poptimism.
Yeah, yeah.
The idea that, like, old white male rock critics have, like, defined what is the great canon of all-time music is, like, mostly the same kind of band from, like, the 60s and 70s and, like, now. And pop music being equally as valuable, even if it does appear to be less weighty because it's on Rolling Stone's top 100 albums of all time.
Right.
The idea that Carly Rae Jepsen is doing as equally important work as the Stones ever did, or the Beatles, or Zeppelin, like that sort of thing. Or Britney Spears, or things that we would think is lightweight, actually do matter.
Right, because they are affecting a population of people and, you know, feeding a need that they have.
Yeah.
Whether it is, being, like, having that escapism, getting through another day, or for the more artistic, heady stuff, making them think the deep questions. Like, those kind of music fans are going to that music for that, whereas the other ones are going it for something lighter and, you know, something to make their time on this earth more palatable.
Also, it's not like you don't think deep questions when you are confronted with ass in those jeans. Like, who is to say?
I'm thinking the deepest question.
Hello.
Who's the POV?
Well,
that's
not just a music thing.
What kind of jeans?
I've been thinking about this a lot, like, in terms of art and filmmaking and, you know, all kinds of cultural production. Like, men have, for white European Eurocentric men have defined forever what genius means.
Right.
And that extends to women. It's not like we as women grow up separately in some other society. We all believe what genius is like, you know, the filmmaking of the 60s, like you know, neorealist painting of the, like, everything is defined by, like, what men have said is genius, and men have written the history books, and history is written by the people who write it. And
absolutely.
And so our whole idea of what kinds of data is believable is based on a Eurocentric idea, whereas, like, if you look at, like, a more Afrocentric model, like, anecdotal storytelling is much more it can be seen as much more believable, or it's given more gravity because it's tied to a person's actual reputation in their community. And our whole perspective has to be seen at some point as out of whack in the global context. I really believe that, and I think that we're coming to that point in terms of, like, our pop culture, which I'm really excited about.
I think about this all the time. I think about, like, what is defined as high art in the modern age and who are considered the auteurs, and, you know, sort of making me reflect on the, you know, pieces of pop culture that have really affected me in ways that I feel, you know, people talk about in history books being the canon, the literary canon or the filmic canon or whatever. If I'm being honest, you know, something that I think about all the time that has had a lasting impression on me are things like season 2 of Project Runway, or, you know, like random Coen Brothers movies that have, you know, been forgotten by time because
the Lady Killers,
the Lady Killers. Yeah, shouts out. No, things like that, you know. And it also makes me think, Chuck Klosterman came out with a book a couple years ago that posed a question of what is going to be sort of being a part of that canon, and what's going to be, you know, sort of the lasting impressions that are going to define us in the history books. And it's called But What If We're Wrong? You know, the things that we consider.
I love that.
Yeah, the things that we consider to be, oh, yeah, Breaking Bad is going to be the thing that everyone's going to look back and go, what an amazing TV show. It was a perfect TV show. But I think that even in that book, he poses the argument against, devil's advocate against Breaking Bad, saying, like, well, you know, usually the things that have a lasting impression through history and pop culture especially are things that either were a technological achievement or disrupted what the genre was or what the climate was, mm-hmm. either politically or socially, you know, for decades to come. And Breaking Bad may be forgotten by time because, you know, sure, a population really enjoyed it, but did it really shatter our expectations in the way that The Sopranos harkened prestige TV? Did it do anything that sort of was the beginning and end of something? Mm-hmm. Or was it a continuation?
Well, and I find this to be a particular salient conversation when you measure the reception to Gilmore and Maisel. Mm-hmm. Gilmore and Maisel, for as much as we talk about like, oh, ASP's arrived and this is a great fit for, they're not different shows.
Right.
When you get to the bones of them, it's centered on a relationship between two strong independent characters, Midge and Susie, Rory and Lorelai. There's the parent characters, there's these references, there's the repartee and all this stuff. But the reception of those two shows are so vastly different. I don't think Amy's like, yeah, I really wanted to upgrade and finally grow up and get out of this like poppy bullshit I used to do. But Gilmore was received in its time and to a degree still now, but a little less so, as like, yeah, that's like a good Britney Spears song. But Maisel is like a great Beyonce album or something. Ooh, I mean, maybe a bad example, but the way people say that Beyonce is high art. Mm-hmm. But Maisel, because of the Emmy stuff, because of the critical stuff, and honestly, because of the money and the budget stuff and the cosmetic appearance to like, I don't know, it's kind of like Mad Men. People receive it in a much different way than the Gilmore stuff.
Two reasons why. One, not that it's a real, I would say, weighty appreciation, but like people are trying to appear as though they appreciate women's stories in a way that they didn't try to appear to do before. And now there's like this, everybody's looking around going, is this good? Well, we have to say it's good because it's women doing it. Yeah. So you can't, you know. And so I think there's like this faux movement about like making sure like women get the, you know, like if it's a woman's story, which is why Handmaid's Tale, I think, is like nobody's talking about it, but it's like one of the worst shows ever made. Like, I think it's so bad.
I haven't
and
actually
no one's
really
talking about it.
But off of that, I will say that what actually like made me, and I don't know if this is schadenfreude or if I just saw the situation for what it was, as like refreshing. Do you guys remember that Amazon pilot Good Girls Revolt?
Yeah, it got canceled after one season.
Yes, so I was actually really happy to see that happen because it was technically bad and written poorly, and I'm sorry to everyone involved. I know that it's a team effort, and you all had wonderful jobs for a period of time.
Yeah.
But I felt like it was so thin in it being like just Mad Men for women, like sort of capitalizing on the style of Mad Men's success, which Mad Men's success, I think, relies entirely on the style.
That's what happens when there's a faux movement.
Right.
A movement of people wanting to appear as though they support women's stories, but without the actual like belief in them, without the actual hardcore. A bunch of executives are sitting around going like, well, we have to give money to this, even though they don't feel in their bones that it's the right thing to do.
Right.
They're not like excited about the story. So they're like, so a story like Good Girls Revolt, which is probably based on somebody's dream of telling this specific story of journalists in the 1960s or 1950s, who, you know, and that probably was a huge part of it. Like, who are these secretaries that became journalists? Like, it's probably a really interesting story, to be honest, that they worked on really hard. And then a bunch of people were like, let's put a lot of money in it and put the hottest actor in it. And then, you know, and then they just like, and then it becomes like all hands on deck in a way that it shouldn't be, and not enough substance and too much.
It seemed noted to death.
Yeah.
It seemed noted to death to the point where it was just like sort of fragments of what you could see was possibly a really good idea, but just sort of like, you know, focus grouped to a point where it was like, oh.
But not enough money, but too many notes, you know, that kind of a thing where it's just like that destroys the show immediately.
I think it's also kind of, it's hard to judge anything before it comes out and you can see the full product. But even for stuff that has come out, I always think it's very strange and almost disturbing when a movement becomes marketing.
Yeah.
So like in eighth grade, if there's a scene where maybe one of the characters gets harassed, they say like, oh, and there's a hashtag Me Too scene in this.
Oh my God.
And like that appears in some, I don't think Bo's doing it, but like that appears in some of the
or an
like,
anti-bullying kind of thing.
Yeah, where it's like, oh, we're going to make a Me Too comedy with Whitney Cummings or whatever the case may be. That's always strange when it's like, and I guess all this to say, as an antecedent or as an antidote to that, I don't think Amy's like, I'm going to make a Time's Up.
No, because Amy's going to like, I'm going to make the show that I've been always making.
Exactly.
So, and then the second half of what I was going to say is like, there's that faux, like, people are like piling on. And I think that's helping it get to the place it needs to be in terms of recognition, because mm-hmm. it's getting the awards, you know, and awards are always problematic. So it's not like the awards are like, this is, you know, they're giving the awards to the show that they feel like they need to give the awards to, so they look okay.
Right.
But then also, they gave her the money. And they gave her the no notes situation. So she has the clout and she has the reputation to get the money, and the she's enough of a shit kicker that she's like, won't. She's like, I'm going to make my vision whether you say so or not. I don't think Amy Sherman-Palladino is taking fucking notes from Amazon right now.
Which something she couldn't do without Gilmore Girls, of course. You know?
Right.
Right. Yeah, it's just a little bit of
so
a track
record. I think this is what happens when you give that auteur enough enough power and enough money to do the thing they've always been trying to do. Mm-hmm. And she also has the experience under her belt of having made the Fluffy show before. But like we all know watching Gilmore, everybody here in this room and everybody who's followed along, like we all know that show has a lot of substance to it. Like the minute I started watching Gilmore Girls for the first time, I thought I was in for, like this really fluffy Britney Spears song. And then I was like, holy shit, it has this really weird, intricate, like, like stuff I haven't seen in other shows. Mm-hmm. Just really, this is really brilliant shit.
By the way, Britney rocks, just so we're clear.
No, I mean, but Britney's but not trying to be Beyonce.
Exactly.
Right, right. But just like our conversation earlier about like the difference between high art rock and like pop culture, for me, Gilmore Girls came to me at a time that I needed it. Mm-hmm. Like I was the most depressed I've ever been, like post-college. And I've seen, I want to say, every single episode of Gilmore Girls at least 7 times. Mm-hmm. Because it is a comforting hug. Mm-hmm. And it is like sort of this, you know, TV family that I think was what resonated with audiences and has made it endure. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to look back, I honestly feel like Maisel is going to be definitely in the conversation about Amy Sherman and her work. But like, I definitely think that Gilmore Girls is going to be the number one. Like, this is what, you know, her history
maybe
book is going
to say.
Maybe because
of Maisel, though.
Yeah, perhaps.
Because now she was able to make her, you know, her Magnolia after the Boogie Nights.
Ooh.
Yeah,
can I draw another comparison? Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll all love and herald and acclaim self-titled Beyonce and Lemonade, but we're always going to dance to Crazy in Love at the
wedding.
Oh my
God, how could you not dance to Crazy in Love?
Love on top. I mean, the woman is just
everything you want and more.
One interesting note, I don't even know what this means culturally, but Maisel was pretty much the last show greenlit at Amazon Prime under the Roy Price regime, who famously got ousted for sexual harassment, allegations, and sexual misconduct, and all that stuff. So that even puts like an interesting shade on it too, where it's like, this was the last thing that got, I don't think he was like trying to cover his ass or something. It's very strange that like.
Or maybe he was.
Maybe.
I don't know.
Maybe it was like an insecure, like I gotta give
the
broad
situation.
Maybe. Ooh. Oh boy. Well, Julia, let's talk about your personal experience with Mrs. Maisel and its marvelousness. You were not on season one of this podcast.
I was not.
Sorry. But you're here for season two.
Sorry.
Sorry.
So bitchy.
Should I apologize? No, I didn't mean it like that.
You're not on season one.
Sorry. No,
No, it's fine.
No, Julia's
such
a great guest.
Girl.
I wish she was on every show that I did.
Oh.
Well, actually, she has been at this point, literally.
Yeah.
But yeah, your personal experience, your take with Maisel. What has it meant to you watching it the last year?
So I have to say up front that I have a personal bias against specifically narrative shows about stand-up. I find that it can be really difficult
Except for Crashing.
Done it perfectly, I think, every time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Unassailable.
I just think that generally, and I'll extend this to feature films, but it's really hard to convey, like, the idea of stand-up, the community of stand-up, and, you know, I feel like, you know, so often when you read scripts or see TV shows or movies about it, it's, like, raised to this impossible level of, like, it's a calling and, like, you know, you're so brave for being out there. And like, you know, the way I'm Dying Up Here treated stand-up was really laughable. I remember in the pilot, which is good for a laugh if you're looking for a laugh.
It seemed like the Studio 60 of the stand-up world.
It really was. Man. But there's this one moment in I'm Dying Up Here in the pilot where like the two comics from Chicago, they're like, we're going to go out there. We have a friend that's like working the store. We're going to do it. They hop in the cab from the airport, you know, LAX, and the cabbie, they're like so excited and talking about like being in LA, and the cabbie's like, oh, you're a tourist? And then the two guys in the back go, no, we're comics. And the way that they leaned into that, I think, said it all. That, yeah, like, A, this person who's making the show doesn't really know anything about stand-up. And B, it is, like, you know, so impossibly detached from the actual reality of it. I've never read a script that in the action line it says, and then the comedian kills their set, and then actually see that transpire.
Yeah.
I find comedy generally to be embarrassing. That being said, when I heard that Amy Sherman-Palladino was doing a show about a 1950s woman who tries stand-up, at first I cringed because I had my bias and I was really scared that this was going to be really bad, just because of, you know, everything that I, yeah, just listed. But then I watched it and I loved it, like everyone in this room does, I assume, because it's not a show about stand-up. Mm-hmm. It's a show about a woman who is trying to sort of break free from, you know, being this oppressed housewife and, you know, figuring out who she is and, like, finding autonomy for the first time. And, you know, of course, there are several episodes that we see, especially in the first season, where she doesn't even do stand-up. Mm-hmm. You know, she's sort of dealing with her personal issues. I feel like it's a woman doing all of that who happens to do stand-up, and stand-up isn't raised to that impossibly high, yeah, you know, like, revered platform. She could be doing anything. And something that I find interesting, and maybe this is a symptom of it being 1950s style stand-up comedy, but I told my husband when we were watching it, like, I actually really enjoy, whether this was intentional or not, that the stand-up isn't funny,
yeah,
in this.
Her stuff, yeah, for you, yeah.
I kind of feel like everyone's, I haven't, like, really laughed at anyone's stand-up in it, but I kind of feel like that's not the point as, yeah, I'm watching it. I'm watching this, you know, woman's journey, and I also love Susie's arc, and I love the parents, and, you know, I love all the different characters. I think that one thing that Amy Sherman-Palladino is so, so, so good at is constructing a show world that we, mm-hmm, want to live in,
yeah,
that we care about everybody, and everybody seems to have, you know, their moment to kind of tell us who they are and, you know, why we should be rooting for, mm-hmm, them, even if they are, you know, completely fallible characters, people that we would never find ourselves to be rooting for. And I'll include, you know, her ex-husband in that. I root for him too. So I think that
so
she's
you do
really skilled
root
in that
for
way.
Joel. This is
I
a,
do root for
this
Joel.
Is a debate on the show.
I know
do you
that
think
people
he's hot?
Hate him.
Is he a hot man?
I do think he's hot.
I thought, Alice, I'll give it to you. I thought he was hot when he was alone in the dark in the garment factory smoking a cigarette.
Very hot.
Yeah.
That was a hot shot.
Yeah.
That think, looked like West Side Story.
You know what it is? I mean, obviously I have daddy issues, so let's just get that out
okay.
there. But I think that it is that I can recognize a man trying his best and being a dummy throughout. Mm-hmm. So he, especially in this episode, I feel, is trying his best. You know, he, like, wants to do good, but, you know, maybe he is a product of the symptom that he grew up in, that mm-hmm. he has this sort of machoism to compare himself to. And, you know, he is only using the tools that he has. But I think that he is good intentioned at his core. So that's sort of why I don't think that he's, you know, the villain in this.
Mm.
But he did cheat on her, so we kind of hate him. But I
mean,
think that he's trying to do something.
I feel like they're writing, maybe inadvertently writing a really complex male character. I mean, I've talked extensively about this, but do you think that Joel feels like he is thrust into this into this position at the warehouse, and that it's like, well, it's all on him? And do you think to a certain extent he enjoys that position? Because
of being the hero?
Of
that?
Being the reluctant. It feels like Joel always wants to be like a reluctant, mm-hmm. you know, well, I got to fix it. It's all on me. And it's like, I got to get you an apartment because I got to do the right thing. And it's like,
right.
I feel like they've written a really, really complex
I felt
modern
that.
Man where it's like, this guy keeps going around being like, listen, I got this, okay? Mm-hmm. I got my beard kit, and I'm going to take care of it.
Right.
And everybody's like, no one's asking you to do this stuff, dude. You got to stop.
I mean, I haven't watched.
Stop looking at me.
I haven't watched beyond the episode that we're discussing today. So I didn't want
neither
it to sort of bleed into
no,
other
me
elements.
Neither.
Yeah. But I do feel that, you know, off of that, they may be setting the same sort of narrative arc that they are, you know, going with Maisel or Midge, you know, that he is reckoning with his gender roles that he feels obligated
yeah.
to fulfill.
Yeah.
And I really hope that he's going to, you know, in some way find his own independence from that and realize that, you know, being the hero is not going to be the answer for him for his happiness and sort of finding, you know, whether his happiness exists elsewhere outside of the nuclear family, I hope.
Yeah.
Well, let's get into it. Let's,
yeah.
let's talk about this. Is episode 202. Oh,
Midway to Midtown.
Midway to Midtown. And the Amazon Prime synopsis is Midge and Susie continue building Midge's stand-up career despite Midge's reluctance to tell her family and friends. Abe and Rose enjoy a new lifestyle. Joel offers some business advice to his parents and makes an effort to do right by Midge, like we were talking about. So it's time for our favorite segment every week of this show.
12 o'clock rock, we're going to pop around the culture tonight.
That's the best. The culture.
Every pop culture reference in the episode in a supercut. It's Pop Around the Culture Tonight, 202 Midway to Midtown.
Bigger than Toady Fields.
Wait. Before John Wayne was famous,
they go to Morocco with Bob and Bing.
Rolf is singing Brecht.
Charles Atlas.
It's not Gershwin.
Jackie Vernon.
James Mason's.
You have Kaufman and Hart write this bit?
Going to a mini pearl lookalike contest later?
Proust. Proust.
Rodin loves Big Hand.
She's gonna go through life looking like Tim Tam.
Let me guess. Floyd?
I'd work up a hot rendition of Swanee if I were you, Matt.
Swanee. Oh, boy. I didn't know that they stayed in Paris in this episode.
You didn't know that they stayed?
Like, I thought...
Did you watch it and you saw
it? No. Still didn't know? Did they?
Or you did not you didn't anticipate
watching
them.
The previous episode, I did not anticipate that they would stay in Paris for this episode.
I'm really mad because when I watched this episode, I was like, last week on the show, I was like... there's no way to prove this because it's just in my head, but I was going to say, like... My prediction is that they stay in Paris and they fall in love again.
Yeah.
Wow. And then they did. And I'm like, fuck, why didn't I say it? Because I was like, I called it. I knew this was going to happen. I knew Abe was going to stay. And Abe was so frustrated. And then when Midge left, I was like, oh, there's no other way that this can possibly work out. They're like, we're going to cut two and it's going to be Abe enjoying Paris. Because of course.
Right.
That,
right.
I think, is the single cutest shit that's ever happened on this show.
It's insanely cute.
That montage, like the montage to the Sinatra song, but also them sleeping in the teeny tiny
bed.
And loving it.
And loving it.
They loved it, baby.
And they loved it, baby. Some bed.
When I watch scenes like this, I really have to, and we text a little bit about this, like, I really have to get over.
Alice, we text. Do you feel left out? We can do a group text.
No, I'm fine.
Text.
I'm getting a phone call right now.
Okay.
Your phone's downstairs.
You're downstairs.
But it's hard for me sometimes. Like I feel like a dad watching this sometimes, just being like, how expensive is the show? They're still in Paris, and you know they're having a dance number.
Yeah.
But
I
have to like put that aside and be like,
here's the thing though
about
the budget. I feel like people coming. Okay, so I talked to my trainer, my personal trainer at my gym.
Oh, good. I was gonna see if you checked in with him about The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
I did. Yeah. Because he's kind of my canary in the coal mine for like regular people watching stuff because he's
not really.
He does acting.
Feel
and
good
he's
for that.
What we call a normie.
He's a bit of a normie. Yeah. I mean, he's getting into stand up again. He used to do it, but he's not like a. He doesn't perform a Meltdown. You know, he just tells the story. Like, so he's sort of like middle America. He has like an. He's my touchstone. So he was like, who thought that show would be such a hit? You know, it's just so interesting how, like, that show seems like it would have been a risk, but it's so good. And I'm like, okay, so I think people are seeing this, a lot of people, very, very, very many people are seeing this that have no idea that that this show has anything to do with Gilmore Girls. And so when you see it anew, out of nowhere, you're like, oh, it's just like a new Mad Men, and the fact that it's in Paris and it's on location and it looks so rich and, you know, colorful, and there's so many crazy scenes with all this money where people are floating through department stores. It makes just sense. It's not like it's like, whoa, because we're watching it with all this context. But I think without context, it just seems like a very good show.
There is there's something to be said about the spectacle of it.
And I mean, it's not like they misuse it. It's not like it's just like for reason, like a Michael Bay movie. The richness of the experience of being in Paris. It's only told with the experience of being in Paris.
But there is a scene in episode 3 where Abe does set $1,000 on fire. And I read that they did 200 takes of it.
Right. But they could. I mean, like it was such a big turn for him.
Yeah, it was important for his character.
Because he's so professionally minded.
Just burning. So it was a big Amy as a flex just like has a scene where the Maisels burn like a bucket of real cash.
It's weird because all the shots of like the Chrysler building and stuff like that from above, I mean, They could have shot that with a drone.
Yeah.
Right.
But Amy insisted on having a handheld on a glider.
Mm-hmm.
And
and then a hot air balloon as
obviously
like a
B-cam. Obviously, they need
yeah.
the B-cam hot air. And she was know, but it's in it, but I feel like it pays off.
It works for, so it's been narratively it important.
Could you imagine like a Babadook on a glider? Yeah, like a hand.
I don't have to imagine. I'm going to draw it when I get home.
But I will say to that, I mean, this specific argument of like the attraction of the spectacle of it, yeah. I think that what we're learning is that Maisel does have the writing and the character development to support, you know, to have yeah. even more of it. It's sort of that's initially what's drawing you in, but then there's more to the show than that. Mm-hmm. I feel like what we're finding right now, and granted, I have not watched this show, but the Romanoffs sounds like it kind of bombed.
Yeah.
And I think that what we're all kind of collectively learning is that for Matthew Weiner and what he is trying to accomplish, like people really enjoyed the spectacle of Mad Men and the style of Mad Men, but that when he does like a non-period show, and granted, again, I have not seen the show, so I don't know, maybe it's like the quality of the writing is like so shit poor, that, but there's a drop off for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Disagree, but I'm not going to explain it.
Okay,
I'm
great.
Just kidding. No, no, I
love
think
that.
They enjoyed the spectacle of Mad Men. For sure. No question. It was like a hugely influential, but also...
When we're saying spectacle, that show was dirt-ass cheap. Like, they never went outside.
No, I
so
know.
We're talking about, like, production design.
We're talking about
yeah,
production
yeah, yeah, yeah.
style and costume.
And mm-hmm. also the fact that we're, like, inserted into, and look at that toaster, you know?
Yeah, like, there's something fun about it. It was like a living museum.
Yeah, it was a living mm-hmm. museum.
Yeah.
But also, they... I believe they could have made Mad Men and it would have been somewhat of a success without the period element because of the fact that it was, like, you cared so much about... you know, what was going to happen with Betty and with Don and with, you know, Peggy. Like,
yeah.
I really think that, like, it has to be this serialized thing. And I really believe that for you to be successful in making a show that's not serialized, that's like a recurring, like
anthology's
a Black Mirror
tough,
or something
yeah.
like that, it's really tough. Okay, anthology is what it's called, right?
Yeah. yeah.
You know, like, imagine if Friends was an anthology.
It was different. It was a set of different white groups of friends every episode.
Oh, I thought we were going to go Arrested Development season 5 style, where it was every season is a different character, or every episode is a different character.
Oh, like episode 1 was Ross, episode 2 was yeah. Rachel. Were we talking about, we were talking about this the other night, how crazy and stupid we feel that Netflix is spending $80 million to keep Friends. Friends is, for those that don't know, Friends is maybe, we don't know for sure, but it's suspected to be the number one most streamed show on Netflix, which is why they're spending so much money
yeah.
to keep it, rather than like, I don't know, you give that money to a lot of other people making TV shows
I know,
or comedy
I know.
Specials
but Gen
or philanthropy.
Z don't give two shits about new shows.
Don't you feel insane that it's like, yeah. I'm just going to watch the same
well,
show
Well, this
again.
Is my
I know.
You know, my gripe with that is that they have this platform where they... I mean, and it's only for stand-up. I don't really care about the other shows. It's fine they turned down my pilot or whatever. But, like, my stand-up special and a bunch of other people's stand-up special, like, Paul F. has a stand-up special that he just got the rights back to, and they're like, we don't think... They're, like, not interested in airing it. It's just
oh,
like
Netflix?
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. just, like,
it's
they
wild.
Used to be making specials. And
yeah.
now they're, like, not. They're just giving Jerry Seinfeld $60 billion.
Oh, yeah.
And they're not in the game of stand-up in a way anymore. They've kind of just stepped out of caring about it, and now they're just giving money to whoever is, like, the shitty club act of the du jour. And, like, or the big-name person they're giving Chappelle so much money. But, like... That is changing the game, and again, I talked to my trainer about this, and he's like, where do I go to watch, like, I watch all the Netflix stand-up specials, and they're all pretty bad. Like, what is a good, you know, like, is there, where would
Joe
I go
Rogan's
to,
is really
right,
good,
right,
I'm
right.
just kidding.
Where would I go to see a good stand-up special? And I'm like, that's so interesting. I bet people in the, you know, the rest of, who don't have access to, like, the podcast scene or whatever, they aren't... don't super have their finger on the pulse, are probably thinking stand-up isn't very good right now.
Yeah.
Because of the fact that Netflix, the only game in town, has just decided to not air any
of it.
But
just that there's a lot of it, yeah.
yeah. Yeah, there's just a lot of terrible stand-up. And it's like, there's always been a lot of terrible stand-up. It's just that the one place where it would go on TV is now kind of gone.
Yeah.
And now the place that replaced that is now deciding that this is the terrible shit they're going
to
put on.
It's a bizarre time right now to be a creator and to be pitching shows, to be doing stand-up specials, you know, for all of it. And I think that especially with Netflix, which, you know, we are sort of given this promise within this industry that, you know, oh my God, there's so many streaming outlets right now. It is actually such a great time to be a creator because you can go to all these different outlets and just continue to pitch your stuff. But what is happening as we're seeing is that, you know, A, there's no more tastemakers. It's all just subscriber numbers, and it has been for a while, but we thought that that only existed on YouTube, and now we're seeing it with Netflix. Netflix at first, I think, approached with House of Cards and said, no, we are a tastemaker and we want to produce art. But then, of course, you know, they became this big monopoly business model. And so now it's just really all about numbers. We're hearing all these different things. I just heard that like YouTube Red is like shutting down, going, hey, we have some great shows, but we're just going to stop like greenlighting things after that and then just sort of see how things play. And, you know,
well,
I've been rejected by Netflix twice this year. So like,
well, and Netflix, what's going to happen with Netflix, I'm pretty sure, is that they're going to raise their subscription rate. And so I think Netflix is going to become a CBS All Access situation where I'm not subscribing to CBS All Access all months out of the year. I wait until my shows come back on. So I'm watching The Good Fight and Star Trek. And when Star Trek and The Good Fight come back, I'm a subscriber again. And then I take away my, you know, whatever $15 a month. And so it's going to be piecemeal subscribing for people because I'm not subscribing to Netflix anymore once they go up to whatever $16 a month I have to pay. No, I'm not doing that. Once I watch my shows and then I'm out because they don't have the content anymore. And nobody does. And it's going to have to be people. And so until it all comes back to like internet is the TV again, well, however they figure that out.
That's why I'm curious to see sort of like when there is like a huge ship that sort of raises with the tide, like Netflix, you know, there is going to be a reaction from the other places like Hulu and Amazon. And then whatever the fuck is going to happen with this Disney Plus bullshit. I have no idea. So I think
Apple.
That it's going to be good.
Is
and
that
bad.
Apple? Disney Plus?
Different. Different. Apple, no one knows anything about Apple except they put out really good press releases.
Because
it's like Steve Carell and Jeff.
I have one in on what one thing they're pitching to Apple and Apple's considering for stand-up.
Oh,
and
it's very bad.
Oh.
Apple wants to be NBC in like the 1990s. They don't want to be HBO. They want to be like, we're for everyone. Like they want to do must see TV
I think the dream died with CISO, guys. I'm going to say
that's
that.
That's hilarious.
Right
guys, we're here to launch our platform. CISO Part 2 is coming out. We're starting a new streaming platform.
CISO Run.
I wonder if Midge would get a special on Netflix. Ooh. I wonder if she
think probably would because she interacts with the audience a lot. I don't know. She's got an Ellen DeGeneres.
Yeah, she's got it because her comedy's not very good. So yeah, but like it's
relatable.
Good in the context of the show. And I agree with you about this, that there's like the world that you want to inhabit. In the world that they inhabit, people laugh and you're like, I believe it. I'm not like, that's not funny. Why are they laughing?
Right,
I'm like, for these dumbheads, it is funny.
And she's disrupting it, you know, so much in being this, a woman on stage.
Mrs. Maisel is a disruptor.
She's a disruptor. But speaking her mind you know, giving what I feel like really defined, especially alternative comedy in the 90s of like that sort of, you know, like honest commentary instead of it being this, you know, facade of
set
like, let's talk about, set up punch.
That's what I felt.
Let's
is
talk
she
about
was,
cereal. Let's
she
talk
was
about
really
this. She's very
Garofaloing all over the stage
she
in that last set
totally
where she's like,
Garofalo.
I got mustard. What else? What else?
I know. What else? I'm on my period.
Notes. Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
So, but I want to go back to the Abe and
Please,
Rose quickly because at the scene at the end of the movie, the scene at the end of the episode, they leave and they realize they have to go back to their life. And a little bit, it's like, there was a voice in my head that was like, oh, you only happy in Paris, witch lady. You know, like, it's like sort of like, that's hard to relate to that she's like, because she found herself again and you want her to be able to have herself again.
This whole show is hard to relate to.
But
on
a little
level.
Bit, it's like, you can only be yourself in Paris. Okay. But like, then she had left and she had to leave Simone. And the first episode is titled Simone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I thought they would just bring Simone. Why
and
would they not just bring Simone?
There's a scene where they put her down and it's very graphic.
First, that was an extra Amazon Plus Plus membership. For some reason, I always knew that they were going to leave Simone and really? That it would be symbolic.
It hurt.
Yeah. Simone Ball.
It hurt.
Simone
Ball. It's a Simone Bowl of what she had to leave behind. Boy.
I found, I mean, there was a
the bit Simone Bullism was.
Simone Bullism. I
Are
found
you okay?
A bit of relatability to her quandary in finding herself in a different place, but then making the realization, or whether she did make this realization because they didn't really broadcast it, but like, you know, doing stand-up tours is a way of sort of escaping and finding yourself or trying to find yourself. But, you know, what you find is that you bring yourself with you and mm-hmm. that, you know, just because your environment has changed Damn. Doesn't mean your circumstances or, you know, the demons that you are, you know, struggling against have changed.
Right.
And I do think that that's something that she realized in that last moment, perhaps.
And right. When mm-hmm. she was back.
Yeah. Can I
play the clip of, because there's two back-to-back scenes where
yes.
two couples, one has picked out an apartment for the other without the other one knowing. In the first one, Joel picks out an apartment for Midge to live in that he's going to pay for with his new job crushing it at the garment factory, I guess. In the second one, Rose picks out a place for her and Abe to live in Paris for forever. And they have the following conversation.
This has been a wonderful vacation. But it's time to go back to our life.
What life? My daughter does not want my guidance. You have no need for my input. I'm alone in New York. Here, I have art. I have independence. No one looks at me with pity.
No one looks
at me. Poor Rose. She's too fragile to be told the truth, too delicate to confide in. She'll shatter. Here in Paris, I'm shatterproof.
In Paris, I'm shadowproof. My daughter doesn't want me there. I feel like it's a Sia song. That.
It's it's definitely a sequel to Fireproof. It's Shatterproof, the Christian film. So yeah, Rose feels shatterproof.
I liked that Paris. Moment a lot.
But you know, upon reflection, it does feel like Alice is saying. A rich lady acting up like
I know
go back like talk to your husband say I need things I need you to listen to me mm-hmm. I need you to cater to my needs mm-hmm. more you're not being there for me
exactly.
you're not being a present partner and then by the end he does
I know
oh,
he
d- and I signed us up for dance classes
I
Arthur Murray
him.
We can't be caught out again like that night on the Seine I mean we were adorable but our technique was terrible
Shalom
so I'm gonna give the credit where credit's due and be like, okay, so the reason she's being such a sourpuss is that she feels like in the only time that they've ever connected since they've been married for 20 years is in Paris and now
is doing
they're
poor
going
people
back.
Cosplay.
Right.
And now they're going back. And she's like, I don't want to go back to that life, man. Like, and he's like, it's gonna be different, but we're gonna go back. And
yeah.
she's like, here he is again. He's just not listening to me.
Yeah.
Then they go back and he does. And she's like, okay. But I kind of feel like, okay, I get it why she's being a sourpuss when they're leaving, but it does feel like at the same time it's like, but I wanted to stay in Paris.
It does have that. Though I will say I feel like I was in that boat with you just like, oh, because sometimes people just want to be right and they want to be the victims
yeah.
and blah, blah, blah. But I do appreciate giving her that moment after that clip
yeah.
you just played, like, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. Giving her the moment of, you know, I think it's when he mentions like, audit this art class. Come on,
yeah.
come on. That smile she has to
yeah.
show that she is a mature person who is not going to stew and pout and be, you
yeah.
know, the victim in this for too long.
Like, and he's giving the dance classes and it's like, but it's not just like, hey, I got us dance classes so that you'd stop being upset. He's like, no, he's a different guy now.
He's
yeah.
changed.
He really has.
He actually
that
changed.
That situation
the arc
changed
of the
him
now.
And he's like, we're doing this stuff
I
together now
it.
As a team. So you got to get on board. And she's like, oh, okay. Yeah,
yeah,
that is a different thing.
I love them.
This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Squarespace. Now, Squarespace is, I'm going to say it, gang, it's a product I actually use. I've been using it for 10 years now. I've made every single website I've made in the last decade using Squarespace because Squarespace actually has everything I need. If you want to start a completely personalized website with a new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint is your answer. Choose from professionally curated layout and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business, and optimized for every device. Easily launch your website and get discovered fast with integrated optimized SEO tools so you show up more often to more people and grow the way you want. You can do so much with Squarespace, like email campaigns for outreach. You can have analytics to find out who's visiting your website and why.
You can have eShop e-commerce functionality. I used that when I was doing my little bake shop on there for a while. I stopped doing it, but man, the website I had for a little bit looked really good because I used Squarespace. And there's so much I didn't know about setting up my shop that they were able to answer for me over the chat and their award-winning 24/7 customer support. So right now, go to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/Gilmore Guys to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. That's squarespace.com/Gilmore Guys. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, let's talk about your social battery. What is it right now? Is it drained? Is it bursting with energy? Why is it at the level it's at? There's all these external factors that can make it the way it is. Maybe you're less social during certain seasons. Maybe you're experiencing a lack of boundaries with certain people that's making it more drained than it needs to be. Well, either way, it can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. What's the right amount of socializing for you, and how do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need a little more alone time. Well, either way, therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. I've been in therapy for 11 years now, and it has been vital and crucial for figuring out how to not overexert myself socially, to keep my battery at a good charge, to not keep it too drained when I'm dealing with all the people that I actually want to be dealing with, and not dealing with people in the way that I don't want to be, which is, of course, due to a lack of good boundaries or how to cope with people. And you learn how to do those things with therapy, because therapy gives you the tools to tune in to yourself and understand, oh, I need this. I don't need this. I need to communicate this. I need to say this. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/Gilmore Guys today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Gilmore Guys.
I will say, I forget which part. Actually, it might have been this part, but this is the part. I've done this twice in a row now where I've skipped to the end to see, wait, did Daniel write this one? And now it's like, who knows or who cares, but this scene.
I'm sorry. I'm having a little trouble focusing here right now. I'm very high, and there's just a lot of words coming from a little yellow light source, and it's freaking me out. Feels like a flower is yelling at me.
Pretty wacky. Susie gets high, staying at the Maisel's residence while the parents are away in Paris.
Why did you think it was Daniel?
Just like a character gets high and takes a bath. Just feels like a kind of wacky tabacky Daniel thing.
Yeah.
I'll feel it more when it actually happens. But yeah, I'm always so suspect. But with these, with the old shows, it's like you would see the credits at the top during the, you know, the first act.
So you'd watch it with that in mind. Yeah.
But now I have to confess, I need to not do it because it's ruining my enjoyment. But now I'm like skipping to the end and checking it out to see who, and then going
back. It's only them, between the two of them, being credited as writers of the episodes.
I think Sheila Lawrence got one last week, or last week, Kevin, last season.
Take a break. Enjoy your life.
Thank you.
You know?
I've been waiting to hear that from you for a long, long time.
You have?
Yes.
Wow.
From you specifically. Other people have said it, but not you.
That's weird.
I felt pressure from you in particular.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. We get to see Imogen again, as played by Bailey DeYoung.
Yes.
Who
first introduced to us through Bunheads?
Through Bunheads, as little
Such
Jenny.
Such a great program.
She just became a mother. So
did you know that David's show Bongheads was almost going to go?
Oh my God. Bong.
But then Freaks and Geeks came out.
Oh, well, I was going to say that Chuck Lorre High show came out. Yeah. That was probably in the same camp. They're like, well, if Chuck's going to get it.
Yeah.
And he's got Kathy Bates.
Oh, but so a friend of mine, actually, she texted me and wanted me to make a note of this. This is a request. Sometimes friends request I say things on the show about this line. They're going through the books. Mrs. Moskowitz is helping out the garment factory, which is apparently a disaster. The Maisels have mafia ties now and borrowed a lot of money. And Mrs. Moskowitz, who we remember from season one, is going through it. She says,
and this is ancient Aramaic, which has been a dead language for 2,000 years.
And my friend texted me to say, false, it's still spoken, written, and read by a few million people around the world, including yours truly.
Wow.
So that's a fun fact.
That's a fun fact.
Yeah.
Huh.
She got that one wrong.
Mm-hmm. It's weird in the age of Google, too, to have like that kind of inaccuracy.
Do you think the Paladinos use Google?
Oh, that's true.
They it crushes their creative process.
I love thinking of them as just like the most steampunk Luddites in the world.
Yeah. They use
I have seen an image of them together. I was going to say, like, I can't.
It's just them constantly being like, what does it say about that language? It's like, oh, the page is torn out. We got to get a new encyclopedia.
Yeah.
You said we'd do it last week. Blah, 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 blah,
right, blah. Right. They're constantly consulting their cool nephews and nieces for pop culture references.
There was a set photo release of Amy and some of the cast a couple of years ago, and she was wearing an Apple Watch in the picture. And it did look like I was seeing Abraham Lincoln text or something. I was like, what are you doing? What is this? So yeah, Joel's taking control, taking charge. I actually like this aspect of his character, that it is like a problem solvery thing. And it is like, maybe there's like male 50s kind of gender role archetypes of like, I'm going to see a problem and get things done and blah, blah, blah. But honestly, like the aggression and like trying to help your family and like, you guys have run this shit into the ground.
Right.
And trying to be helpful and not recoiling, I do think is admirable, where it's like, it's a small fire, but he's trying to put it out where he can. And he is trying to be helpful and fix. And like, I didn't find it, I would usually find this sort of thing aggressive or aggro or annoying, kind of like when a male's like, call the shots and do this and do that.
Because when I saw it, I thought you were going to be like, oh, he's going to hate this.
I was going to hate, really?
Yeah, because last week you had mentioned you were like, I hope it doesn't become the like, Marvelous Mrs. Maisel and like What's Going On with Joel show.
Well,
and it is doing right. That.
No, I'm saying I like this as a character motivation, as like a structural thing. I don't know what we're doing. Like, is it just like the Garment Factory show that's like the C plot?
We all enjoy
episode?
Kevin Pollak, so perhaps there's some of that going on of like, let's just check in with Kevin Pollak a little bit more.
Unfortunately, Christopher Walken isn't famous in this timeline yet, so he can't do his famous Walken impression on the show.
Well, I do think that it is, you know, and I believe this ambition for him way more than him as a stand-up comic, and I think that, you know, maybe part of that was intentional, that his arc was that he didn't have the artistry and the ambition for that kind of, you know, expression.
Right.
But I think that he's trying to save his parents' business and like save one family because he can't save his own, you know, with Midge.
Totally.
Yeah. So he's getting that out.
I wonder what this episode, even just thinking about this episode, what does it lose if you cut out all the garment stuff, but you still have the scene with him and Midge at the apartment? And he just mentions like, I'm working at the garment factory. They've done a lot of messed up stuff. I'm trying to fix it. And it's just that. And it's the episode's like 8 minutes shorter. What does it lose? Like,
if you see the connection between Joel and his family as being supporting the general arc of like where these two people are going, and you don't think that Joel is incidental to the story, because I don't think he's incidental to the story as the father of Midge's children, as the person that she is still currently in love with, you know, I don't see why he's incidental. I mean, he also is the reason that she's doing stand up in the first place.
I guess it starts to feel like Luke and Liz scenes. Hey, big brother. And it's like, I guess we're going to meet TJ now. He's going to be a runner.
I see what you're saying, but I don't think it's that. I mean, there is a little bit of that with like
tighter.
The mom coming in. It is tighter. But I do feel like this is all lead up. We get that backstory with, you know, him and sort of giving us more visual clues and visual information of like, you know, what his intentions are and why we may be able to root for him. But I think that this all leads up to a very important scene between himself and Kevin Pollak, his father, in like the bar where it's like, you know, he is rising up as a man in his father's eyes, which is a very important moment, or at least he's trying to, when they have that kind of, you know, back and forth. And you really don't know who has the power in that scene because, you know, you've got, you know, the son sort of pointing out like all of these like, you know, inconsistencies in the books and you guys are doing this all wrong. But then it's also like, well, you don't know how this business is run and it has been humming and we have all this. So it's like, both of them are right and both of them are wrong at the same time. And I feel like that's a very important moment that then informs his motivations for, you know, what he does with Midge.
But it does ultimately point to reconciliation being the end game.
Yeah.
Because the thing is, like, It just feels absolutely irrelevant. Not Alice says no.
Alice says no. Because think about it this way. His arc right now is that he's like constantly, you know, Joel tries to find himself, right? So he's like now in this position of, well, I'm not a comic, you know, but I am. Joel is a business innovator. You know, he makes
a disruptor.
He's good at he's good at making the risky move that saves the company and pushes the envelope and actually like creates some sort of success. Like he like his move to buy the building. Like he has this like kind of, I don't know, he has the DNA for that, and he's like, and I feel like his arc in this episode is he's approaching his dad, he's confronting the patriarch that has kind of put him in this box with his uncle's company. And he's making big moves, and he feels good about himself in this circumstance. So that's what he takes into the situation with Midge, where he's like, all right, okay, I got this. You know, this is something where I can make a difference, I can make things better, and I'm going to now move to this other part of my life where I can also do that, and I can also fix things and make things better. And Midge slaps him down. So I like the dynamic. I like that if the setup is Joel constantly trying to figure out his life and then going to Midge and being like, duh, and then she's like, no.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because that is interesting. That's interesting that like he's building himself up and it's still not working for that core relationship.
Yeah, and it definitely feels more loaded and you feel the weight of it more. After seeing those previous scenes, and then you see the scene of them in the apartment. And like you feel it more than it would be by itself. I always just think, and again, I think it's just like kind of tuning in my expectations of like what ASP wants to do and whatever the show is. Cause this, like storylines like this often feel like excesses of like, well, we have a 22 episode season on a network that we have to fill the time. This feels like kind of a storyline where it's like, yeah, let's follow Kirk and one of his jobs. Like it feels like one of those.
Right, right, right.
But I do see how like certain things do become more resonant with it.
Yeah.
I just would not be so sad if it was like recurring Joel Maisel, like if he was in every two episodes or like
I don't think so at all.
Really?
No, for some reason.
It seems essential.
I think we never doubt that it's her story, but I think that it informs her story even more because it gives more conflict for, you know, things that she has to either overcome or ask big questions for.
Yeah, I think that's especially because of your ex-husband, whether he stays your ex-husband or not, if he's your ex-husband and you have kids with him, that person, whether they're a series regular or not, is a part of your family and your story for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's just no way around those two things. And Joel could move out of New York, for sure, and then become the Christopher the recurring. But, like, he would still have that, I think, core cosmic connection to Midge. Mm-hmm. I don't think that would ever go away.
I want to play that scene where he does present her with the apartment.
What's the matter?
I just don't like you telling me where I'm going to live.
I wasn't telling you.
Where are you going to live, huh?
Me?
Yeah, you're still at your parents', right?
Yes.
Well, if you can tell me where I'm going to live, then I can tell you where you're going to live.
Midge.
Turtle Bay. You're going to live in Turtle Bay.
Where the hell is Turtle Bay?
I don't know. It's right off three subways. Have fun.
Why are you angry?
I'm not angry.
It's a nice apartment.
I had a nice apartment.
I know.
And I lost it because of you.
I know.
And it was right off three subways, too.
It wasn't, actually.
How can you suddenly afford this? Huh? You quit your job, right? Imogene said that you quit your job, and now Archie's gonna get fired.
Why is Archie gonna get fired?
I don't know. Ask Imogene. She said that you walked out and left Archie standing next to the chart that she made.
Imogene made that chart?
Yes.
That was a great chart.
So you get another job?
Midge, I've got it covered.
How?
Do you like the apartment or not?
No.
Fine.
Yes, it's very nice. The phone niche is particularly delightful. I'm sorry, it's not the apartment. The apartment's fine. It's just a lot. I can find my own place.
Okay, find your own place. Just tell me what it costs and I'll pay for it.
With the job you don't have yet?
Midge, give me a break, please. I'm just trying to do some fucking thing right here.
I know.
Great.
I love it.
Great.
Because also, it's not... My other thing is, like, I feel, on Midge's behalf, that she's like, you broke up with me, and now you're trying to buy me an apartment. It's like you're not giving me any time to adjust to, let me get over this motherfucking breakup first before you decide what's happening next.
There's a power dynamic inherent in accepting a gift of that size and then you're living in it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't give a shit if you're the father of my children. Strange. Like, I'm not going to take a gift from you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't take gifts from my mom even.
Whoa.
Hey.
Christmas is around the corner. Like, I wouldn't say things like
my
that.
My mom bought me an apartment. I'd be like.
It happened months ago.
Hey, get out of there.
Weeks ago.
Maybe I do take it.
You don't want to put that energy out in the world at holiday time.
For Christmas 2019.
I was on a roll. I wasn't hearing. I'm saying if she bought me an apartment.
Yes.
I'd be like, no, thank you.
Even if it had pink carpet. And a great little phone nook. I'd be
like, no, thank you. I designed my own life.
I would surely, for sure, I would take that apartment, like, and I would Airbnb that shit immediately.
You would not live in it. You would just make Airbnb off of it.
Yeah. Hell
yeah.
I wouldn't be able to do it.
It's such a funny thing that happens sometimes. Like, there is a little strain of relationships in certain couples and the DNA of you're just kind of bound to repeat stuff or inherit things that like your parents do.
Right.
Like putting those scenes back to back with like the apartment, the new apartment confrontations.
Mm-hmm.
There's a weird almost like melancholy inevitability.
Yeah.
And like, you're just kind of, you're going to keep doing these patterns. And some of this is genetic and passed down.
And with Paris going back to your old life. And what she feels in when she's feeling really melancholy in that moment, like what she feels is going to be right back to where it was as if Paris had never happened. And that's why it's so delightful to see that it isn't going to be that case.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the club scene because Midge does book a gig. Susie books a gig for Midge, I should say, even though Midge is very scared that her picture is going to get out or anyone's going to find out who she is. But she gets a gig at a club. And the men are very mean to her, and they do kind of sort of harass her.
Singer.
Nope.
Oh, you should sing.
You'd clean up as a singer.
But I don't sing.
Doesn't matter. Just wear that dress.
Hey, so one colleague to another, you and Lenny.
Me and Lenny what?
Well, what he did for you, that was pretty big. You must have done something pretty big for him first, right?
Nothing but respect if you did. Hey, I'd sleep with Lenny Bruce if he asked. The man is a god.
She did not fucking sleep with Lenny Bruce.
Yeah.
And even if she did, that's not why he did the gig. I didn't sleep with him. I know, but my point is, even if you did, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, but I didn't.
I know, but if you did, for fuck's sake.
Wow, little lady's got a potty mouth.
Lenny teach you that also?
I do like that back and forth between her and Susie. It feels very like, you know, their style sort of dialed up to 11.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, I was watching this and going, you know, because I came up in New York about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, not that different.
Mm, I was going to ask about this.
Like, not that different from how guys would talk to you.
And
when,
even
when I started 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So that's pretty crazy. Because, you know, I imagine. I was like, well, because they didn't probably know what it was like going. I mean, I would think it'd be way worse like than that in the 50s.
In the 50s?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, if it was truly, like, perfectly period accurate, it might be just too not fun to watch.
Yeah,
too on any level for this kind of pleasant show.
Yeah.
It has to go through their filter, the ASP filter.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then I loved, I mean, because I totally identify with this, too. I loved her taking shots at them when she got up on stage because when that guy was on stage talking about her and like, oh, I don't think she's going to be very good or whatever, like, that...
Did that
for
happen?
Me, if that ever happened to me or anything similar like that that happens, I'm like, get me on stage right now.
Yeah.
Like, I just, like, that is my fucking, that's like a steak for me.
Yeah.
Like, that guy turns into a T-bone steak.
Woo!
And I'm like, let me fucking at it.
And you turn into a cartoon dog.
I do. I turn into a cartoon. I'm like, oh, woo, God. Like, I love it so much.
Yeah.
So when she got up and did that, I was like, I completely identify with that. Mm-hmm, of course you do that.
Yeah. It
and he paved the road for her to do that, you know, with that comment. I mean, she, in the 50s, had no ground to stand on to sort of fight back with that booker. We always knew that that booker was going to be incredibly sexist and side with the guys. But it is, in the modern age, watching this now in the year of our Lord 2018, it is particularly hard to see that she was completely in the right and, you know, yet still is getting like a real earful from this shitty booker that's saying like, you'll never play in this town
again. Yeah, but she's like, that starts her back from like, day one again. It's like, mm-hmm. That's not a big deal. Like, they just crawled back out of that hole they were in yesterday, and now they're back in the hole again. It's like, who gives a shit? We did it, you know? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We got paid.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? And they're walking out of there. And also, knowing Midge's trajectory and knowing that she's the center of this story and knowing how public the public reacts to her, not long until people start asking for her at that club.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I know.
And I feel like they probably know that at this point. Like, yeah, you say that now, but wait till the tide turns and Midge Maisel becomes a huge deal.
Yeah, she's
and,
starting to already feel undeniable.
Yeah.
It was fun to see that, because we've seen a lot of stand-up sets where it's like, what's she going to do? Is she going to duck Sophie Lennon? Is she going to bomb using Wallace Shawn's little cue cards?
Right.
And this was like, it feels like every stand-up set they show on this show is like a different level in a game that she's playing, but the challenge is always different. Like, okay, how do you recover from like barbs that have been thrown at you like by the previous comics the night before?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How do you react to like this sort of thing bothering you or this thing in your real life happening to you? So it's nice to see that at least like comedy set wise so far, it doesn't feel like, okay, we're doing this again.
We're doing and the we're same doing this thing again. Over and over.
Yeah.
And it's even distinct from the one in Paris, too, where it just becomes, we called it bilingual Nanette.
Yeah, totally. The only thing that I will say, every stand-up set, exactly as you said, is different and has a different challenge. The only thing that I will say that I'm kind of like, all right, let's refresh on this is her just so like conveniently finding a stage to do stand-up in
it's
ways.
It's really weird.
It's insane. Like last season when it was that political rally, I was like, who the fuck is this bitch? Like what is going on? And then even with the last episode in Paris, I was like, you gotta be kidding me. But I think that I appreciated it because, you know, the drag queen element of it, I was like, that's interesting. But even still, I was like, the way that the mic perfectly was set on stage for her to come up and be like, what is this? What is this? Where
magical
am I?
Realism.
Yeah. And so I've got my ticket, I'm taking the ride, but it's still, I'm like, you guys
there's
cannot go to that well
where
so much.
I know, where she's like, she'll be in a museum and she'll be like, is this step I'm on slightly raised up? Like, what's happening? Oh, the acoustics here, it's like there's a, and so what's the art over here?
That's the SNL sketch.
She wanders into like the Metro booth and she like starts doing stand-up over the PA system.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like at a grocery store.
Because it doesn't need to be, we don't need to be hit over the head with the fact that she's good at this and will do it in any context and that she's a performer. All we needed was her doing it at her own fucking wedding.
Yeah.
Then we are done.
I hope she wanders into a church and like pushes the pastor.
The thing about
off.
God is, you know, it's just stupid.
Though I enjoyed it last season, I think that's what, you know, really made me go like, what is this? The most was when she would go to parties and work the party circuit. I was like, if I'm at a party and a woman is like holding
the party
like,
thing,
considering
now I remember.
And considering it stage time, I'm like, what the fuck?
I felt insane.
Yeah, I would. I would.
I did too.
Me too. You feel like you're going insane. Because if I was at that party, I'd be like, hey, why are we all listening to that?
For sure. Absolutely. And
what's going on over there?
Right. You know, and like, we all know because we have comedian friends. And when you're at a party or something and somebody's like actively trying to do material, you can smell it out. Yeah. Like hold court or like just repeat themselves or try out material in a conversation. You're like, fuck you. Be a person.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this was one thing I really appreciated about Brosnahan's performance that I really noticed in this episode is that if Midge Maisel is a superhero, then her signature move is going to be taking the mic off the stand.
Yes.
The take the mic off the stand and backswing is almost identical every time she does stand up. It's like, so
she's shooting
you got to do a blah, 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 blah. Like, it's a really nice piece of acting where it just feels like, okay, now I'm really getting into it. And it seems obvious, like, oh yeah, you take off the stand, you feel more comfortable. But
the way
about, like,
she does it, I don't take the mic off the stand.
There's
that
a precision.
Way.
Yeah.
No. But you still crush it every time.
Thank
Alice.
You.
I was
waiting for it.
I saw Alice open up for She and Him at the Wiltern a couple nights ago, and she was so good.
How was that?
She was so great.
Good,
she was
so good.
Yes.
That's great.
Alice started clapping for herself, so we felt
bad
not doing it.
That's a great gig. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was cool. It was a big, huge crowd, and it's not my gig, so it was easy.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I like that there seems to be an uptick in a trend of like comedians opening for music acts.
Yeah, because it's like, I guess where else the fuck are we going to go at this point?
Right?
Netflix won't have us.
And then especially in LA, you got to get out of LA to do more than 8 minutes. And
blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
It was fun sitting next to normies too that discovered you.
Yeah.
That were there for the band, but they're like, oh, she's funny.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it was very fun. But yeah, so Midge does the set. She starts with all the roast, but then it does kind of, again, kind of Nanette-y, but it does kind of turn into like a TED talk about like women and comedy and stuff.
All comics are comics because something in their lives went horribly wrong. Something went to shit. Either their hairline, Eugene, or their personal lives, me. And Stan. I don't even need to know the details, but looking at Stan, you just want to apologize and tell him everything's going to be okay. Which it won't. Because it's Stan. But men, those over there, and men in general, think that they are the only ones who get to use comedy to close up those holes in their soul. They run around telling everyone that women aren't funny. Only men are funny.
Sorry, give me a minute. Ah, this thing is heavy. Okay, go ahead.
Susie doing the spotlight? I don't know.
Comedy is fueled by oppression, by the lack of power, by
total TED Talk voice.
Yeah,
right.
Disappointment. Yeah.
What is comedy?
By abandonment and humiliation. Now, who the hell does that describe more than women? Judging by those standards, only women should be funny.
Not a laugh line.
And Stan.
Oh, I mean, Stan's a Not a Laugh Line is another title for this show. It is insane.
It's so weird. Yeah, that one.
Holy shit.
Well, there's parts, though, that's like, and Stan. Of course people laugh at that.
Yeah. Right, right, right.
But people, like, people laughing at, like, women. It's like, that's not a laugh. Yeah, maybe it's like, or something. I
really
I don't know
hope in the later episode she goes, that's the setup, ma'am. Like, I want that moment.
I know. Yeah. Why are you laughing already?
Sometimes these do feel like more of the cadences of, like, a congregation during a sermon. Mm-hmm. But it's like, I see where you're going.
But that's what TV stand-up is.
But I did see a new Netflix special by an Indian man who I didn't know who his name was before this, so forgive me. But he was Indian-American, and he had, like, and I'm only saying that for context so you know who I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But, like, because I didn't remember his name. But he had a joke that he was like, women always get told they're asking for it, and like it's so disgusting because like women are so beautiful and wonderful that if they were asking for it, all they would need to do is just ask for it, and then it's like the crowd laughs, and it's like not a laugh line. I was watching it and I was like, no,
they're just nervous.
That's not funny.
Yeah,
they're just so scared that they're like laughing at the end of it, and I'm like, but you didn't write a joke.
Right, right.
You know, like you just are stating some a very emphatic opinion that's worded well.
That became calcified on Daily Show stuff, I feel like. Mm-hmm. The agreement, the clapter.
The agreement,
where it's
clapter.
Like,
clapter,
we agree with this, so I guess I'll laugh as like a symbol of
Yeah, but also Jon Stewart saying it is funny.
Yeah.
Oftentimes,
in a way. Like oftentimes a way, and they haven't really nailed this with Trevor Noah yet, but like the way that Jon Stewart freaks out about it. He's like nebbishly freaking out all the time.
Right.
Nebbishly freaking out.
Yeah, yeah. The expectation is that they're like so on board with him that they want to laugh. Mm-hmm. And I think that also there is, you know, a lot of it in the cadence of just him and addressing things. So I think that laughs can come from, you know, those just different kind of nervous parts. Mm-hmm. But back to this show, though. This feels like this feels like the sound designer is just like sprinkling like rose petals laughs throughout every single, and it does have its own little arc. There's a narrative arc to, we start with a little bit of laughter and then it has to swell, and then it's like it just has to follow a design almost, and then it has absolutely no connection to the actual words being spoken.
I don't agree with this idea that everyone who does comedy is messed up and they're trying to heal the thing that's messed up about them. By the way, it feels a little early for it to have hot takes about like us comedians and what we all go through.
I know.
It feels strange.
Yeah,
but I feel like that's a myth that gets perpetuated a lot, that just it leads to further damage in people.
Yes.
Because especially the more screwed up you feel like you're doing in your life, it's like the more artistic license and like capital you have, where it's like, of course I messed up. Of course I treated this person poorly or abused this substance, because that's what we do.
That We're continues comics, to be man. The normie perspective, and I kind of hate it, where it's like, you know, it goes from everything from like, but you seem so well adjusted. How could you be a comedian, from like a normie saying it, or like, you must stay out all night and, you know, be like into booze or be into this because you're, and like, no, I'm the opposite of those expectations. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget and I don't exactly remember where he said this originally, but Paul F. Tompkins talking about how he, for years, really believed that myth of, like, you have to be messed up, you have to be sad to create really good art, because he happened to create really good art when he was messed up and sad. And, you know, I think that, like, the natural psychology of that is, like, go back to the well that gave you the goods.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that the day that he realized that he could still be funny and be happy was a transformative day for him. And I'll never forget that. Like, I cling to that. It's like, yeah, you really don't need it. It's sort of these weird, like, because life is so chaotic. And it's, of course, like, creative inspiration is so chaotic. Like, where do you go? What do you do? Will the muse strike you at any moment? You don't know. So you kind of try anything. And if you get any clear answers, then that's very, like, comforting. Mm-hmm. But truly, like, it's not that at all. It's just about taking care of yourself and not, you know, adhering to, like, a stereotype or an image of what you think you have to be, that it feels dishonest to you.
Yeah.
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 It always feels like the myth is always so perpetual. I guess this goes across multiple fields. I remember working for it. What?
Nothing.
Okay. I remember working for a composer who was mentored by Elmer Bernstein, the guy who wrote To Kill a Mockingbird mm-hmm. score and all these, like, incredible scores over the last 60 years.
Elmo wrote that?
It's not Elmo Bernstein. Are you kidding me? What the age?
That is the best. I want that to be the isolated clip from this episode.
Okay, Shelly, you are a little flat in measure 16.
Oh, that was good.
It's okay,
that was
right?
A good laugh. That was good.
Put some stank on it. Put some respect on Elmo's name.
But he mentoring for Bernstein, he, you know, you hear all these rock and roll stories, even like in composers, musical composers, like film score composers. There's all these rock and roll stories and mentoring with Bernstein. He's like, I have a wife and a family that I love, and I try not to work too much. I only work these hours. Yeah. And it's just like the well-adjustedness of that. And that was such like a touchstone to model for, like, this guy is actually the best at what he does, but his life is so well put together. He doesn't, if you have trauma in your life, if you have pain and hurt, use it, obviously. But the idea of, like, manufacturing or leaning in or giving yourself a pass
mm-hmm.
on not behaving like a good person
mm-hmm.
as, yeah, gas yeah, in that you, tank is
yeah,
so
Yeah, gas in that tank because
you
treat it as part of your, and I think this is honestly a masculinity thing as well, because a modern masculinity thing, because I do see it in Joel. Mm. Joel really, like, how he really wants to be this reluctant hero. He can't just be he can't just be this, like, happy-go-lucky guy.
Because
he's got to be, like, tortured about it. And it's mm-hmm. like, why?
You because know? It makes him not narcissistic. You know, it kind of like salves his ego.
But it's
for
like
it.
The ultimate narcissism. So it's just
it
like
is,
a.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I said anyway as though I had this really incredible point. And sometimes I do that. And then you have to save me, Kevin.
But she, and you have to save me oftentimes. I always appreciate when
we
you do.
We save
what a good buddy.
Each other. You
we
I'm
do
not
save each other.
Shattered in Paris.
Oh, God.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
I'm shatterproof.
I'm in Paris. I'm shatterproof.
Look for Alice Wetterlin's concept album, The Rose is Shatterproof, on Bandcamp.
Bonus track reprieve.
It's on Bandcamp.
Straight to Spotify.
But in the stand-up act/sermon, she does say women are the only ones that should be funny.
Hey.
Men are blah, 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 blah.
I thought
you think about it.
The idea that, what was the line in specific? She said, like, men are the ones, are the only ones that feel like they have the ability or the right to use comedy to fill mm-hmm. the holes in their lives.
Right, in their soul.
And that was the one where watching it, I did get a little choked up, mm-hmm. just like at that idea of like, oh, damn, yeah, it does feel like mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I need to do this.
Yeah.
And again, it gets back to this idea of like, and not to put too much and create this meta narrative too much, but it's like David Chase is the only one that feels like he gets to use these kind of monster characters, or Aaron Sorkin
is the only
one that gets to feel like.
Right.
So I always wonder how much, and what's so funny about this too is I think Amy is more of a craftsman than an artist with a capital A. Mm-hmm. Like in interviews and stuff, she's never like, well, I really had to dig deep and blah, blah. She's like, I made a thing. I made it really well. We worked really hard on it.
Right.
But like the way someone would say, I made this table.
Yeah. So, but like Basquiat, or like, I'm thinking about the way certain artists and filmmakers talk about their work that are not the, you know, the introspective intellectual type.
Right. Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of artists that just make stuff like David Lynch. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to ask David Lynch about it. He's like, I like the way it looked.
It was weird to me.
Yeah. So it's like, but everybody thinks David Lynch is this brilliant artist.
Right. Right.
You know, but he doesn't talk about his art the way that, you know, he stays in character. And so does Babadook.
Yeah. I think that it's just about finding what works for you and what is the most honest. Being introspective and you know, posing these really deep, heady questions in your art is something that is very important to you, then that is your honest thing. You know, being more of a craftsman like ASP and like, I wanted to create a world and I wanted it to feel like this. I wanted to, you know, provide the public with this kind of glimpse into this one story. Then that's your art too. It's just about being honest with your intentions and what you want to put out.
Well,
in the
also,
world.
But it's, I'm saying in speaking about your art, she's allowing, right. And I think David Lynch does this, allowing the art to speak for itself. Like, well, what were you examining in terms of the greater universal themes? Like, hey, watch the show to find out that.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah, and then there's always going to be that disconnect between, like, the creator's intention and then, like, the critical reaction or the audience reaction. I always think about that movie, Room 237. Mm-hmm. Did you see
the
it?
The Shining documentary. Yeah.
I feel like that is such a perfect movie that sort of embodies what it's like to critique really any art, and I would even extend it. If I were a teacher in the year of our Lord 2018, I would show it in class, in any class, and show, like, you know, the dangers of or how fake news can be disseminated and sort of be mixed around if you pose a very confident argument, because that entire movie is just taking one source material and posing the most confident argument that sounds really, like, legit.
Yeah.
And then literally the next one completely betrays it, but it's just as confident. And so you're, like, so mixed up. And then I saw it in the movie theater, and, like, the audience was in stitches laughing at how absurd it was.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And the director was there, and he was like, I've never seen an audience laugh. So it was in San Francisco, so that probably explains it.
Sure.
But, yeah, I love that movie as being a sort of an example of, like, It's, you know, you can never, there's never going to be one answer, especially when it comes to art. And so you just sort of have to trust yourself.
I gotta see this thing.
It's great.
I've heard it's really great. Mm-hmm. I want to see it.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
but yeah.
Kevin hasn't seen it.
I've not.
Whoa.
Huh. I've just seen trailers.
He acted like
reviews.
He had.
Yeah.
I know, I do that. Yeah. Room 2, 3. I just want to be included and be cool.
I think about it all the time. Yeah, highly recommend it.
But yeah, great episode.
Great episode.
Great scene. Club owner gets mad at her. Booker gets mad at her for, like, shitting on his guys, but says, go before I decide to never book you again, which is like
leaving the door.
I gotta book you again, probably.
Yeah.
Because you did kill, and I can't deny that. And then Susie ends up sleeping at the Gaslight. Very sad, very melancholy.
That was melancholy and cute.
Yeah.
A little cuddly Susie.
Mm-hmm. Usually, this is the part where we would do Twitter Q&A.
Tweet.
But we answered all of the questions in our conversation.
Last
perfect.
Week?
This week.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, give a shout out to the people, though.
Give a shout to the people?
Shout out to the people.
Shout out to the people on Twitter. Oh, boy.
The people who ask the questions, because they like to hear their little handles pronounced.
Yes.
You know, when you say little handles, it's almost as if it's a condescending coddling of our listeners.
I wonder if it is.
Oh, boy. Some of the questions are, when is the first episode dropping of the podcast that we're doing? A lot of these are... What is this?
This is your theme song.
Okay.
Oh, I like that.
Some of these are rhetorical. Like, at Estevan Lewis says, can this show be any more beautiful to look at? So it's like, what do I say? No, it can't be.
It actually can't.
That's a fair point. A lot of Winkin... Thoughts on the expansion of Rose's characterization? That was a request from at King Bob 3. And then someone accidentally asked a question for the next episode instead of this one. So, yeah, I think we got it. But thank you to all.
They accidentally?
Yeah.
What's their handle?
What? What's their handle?
I'm going to make fun of them.
No, come on. It's at Kevin T. Porter is their handle.
Kevin.
No, it's at Hannah A.M. Hannah A.M.
You go out and get your life together, Hannah A.M. I can't believe you, Hannah A.M. Did you arrive at my party early, Hannah A.M.? Bringing uncooked potatoes. Said, I'm making mashed.
The co-host who said, can we talk about the pink soap scene last week?
I did.
Which happened in this episode. We all make mistakes.
Hannah A.M., it's you and me this time.
It's okay.
That's why I didn't watch
the same boat.
So I wouldn't make
I wouldn't be like Hannah.
Right? Mm-hmm. I know. I like parsing it out. This feels good.
Yeah.
Julia, thanks so much for joining us on the show and talking Maisel with us. Where can people find you?
You can find me at Julia Prescott on all the things. The Simpsons podcast is on Maximum Fun, but also on iTunes. And then I also have a show that you can watch that I'm very proud of called Townies, which is the OC in the Old West. It's about the crazy sexy teens of the Pioneer era. Stars Natalie Palomides, Brody Reed, John Ennis, other cool folks. It's on Black Pills, which you can download straight on your phone.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah, dog.
Awesome.
You can follow me at Alice Wetterland, and I have a podcast called Treks in the City. It rocks. It's so good. My co-host Veronica Osorio and I have a rocking good time, and that's me.
Yeah. And you can find me at Kevin T. Porter, and I have another podcast that I love a lot and God loves called Good Christian Fun.
Oh, no, God loves it.
And you can find me on Instagram. But if you don't find me on Instagram, I'll find you first. Okay.
Ew. An aggressive DM slide. We have not talked about how Instagram stories have changed the DM slide game forever.
They have.
But you guys have significant others, so you don't feel as much. Great soundtrack in this episode. What song should we go out on this episode?
The one you want to play the most.
Okay,
one of the French ones, I think.
Oh, one of the French ones? One. Okay. Coin de Rue by Juliette Gréco.
Oh, so cute when you were cuddling.
I know.
Oh, I miss Simone so bad, you guys.
I know. Simone was really cute.
All right, we'll see you next week on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel Goes. Goodbye.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Mon enfance jouait par là, je me souviens de cela.
That was a HeadGum podcast.